We started doing a lot of Hannibal themed gifts since we started recording.
So do you see this?
No, I don't think so. What is it? Is it a notebook?
No, it's a painting.
A painting. No, I haven't seen it. It's beautiful.
It's a painting by one of the artists whose work is hanging in Bedelia's office.
Oh, wow. That's amazing. Yes,
I tracked her
How
down.
How fun.
I tracked it down to a gallery in Canada. And
wow, that is a deep cut.
And the woman at the gallery we were emailing back and forth, and she asked me, well, how did you hear about our gallery? You're in New York. And I emailed back, and I said, this is going to sound very, very crazy, but I know I found out about the artist because I watched the show Hannibal, and she said, that's not crazy. You're the second person who's contacted us about this artwork.
Oh my God, that's amazing.
Because of Hannibal. So I was saying to my partner, see, I'm not so crazy doing this because someone else did it too.
No, not crazy at all.
She pointed out that statistically I was more likely to be a serial killer than someone who purchased art from this gallery because of Hannibal. So moving on from DiGiustivo, I think one thing we really wanted to talk to you about, because you are so active in fandom, is your relationship with the fandom and how you became involved with the fandom and are involved with the fandom and how you feel the Hannibal fandom differs from other fandoms you've been involved with.
Yeah, absolutely. So I guess we can just start at the beginning. I've kind of been in and out of fandoms all my life, but obviously as you adapt, evolve, become, you get older, things become different, you have more autonomy, you can do more, you can make more of your own decisions about how you interact with fandom. So when I was younger, I was in Supernatural. I think I'm towards the latter part of my high school journey and early years in college. I watched Supernatural. I was very into it for a long time, but it wasn't really a communal experience for me partially because I was younger, so I wasn't going to conventions or meeting strangers off the internet or whatever. So I had friends, but I was present in the fandom, but I wasn't I wouldn't say actively engaging in a certain sense. But completely disparate from the fandom itself, just my relationship with the show was kind of my main interaction in the idea of fandom. And then with Supernatural, I really felt kind of chased out of my love from the show in a sense. I felt that they did not really seek to accept a certain kind of fan, and in fact, blatantly rejected certain readings of the text, to the point where, in contrary to the story they themselves have built, they made narrative decisions which hurt, you if you had certain desires from, to see Dean and Cass interact, basically. And that became then hard to continue to engage with that canon material at all, because you were just hoping for something that was not going to happen and, in fact, felt like it was purposefully not happening. So I kind of lapsed from that fandom, and I was kind of out of fandoms for a minute. I tried to go swing dancing and be some normal kid in high school. I mean, in college, swing dance club, whatever. But then, like I said, I saw Hannibal just recur on my Tumblr dash, and I finally watched it. And by the finale, I was throwing pillows at the TV. So obviously, I was very in. And then I just, I think it was just such, as Hannibal would say, fate and circumstance brought me to that moment where the teacup really did come together again. This love of fandom. Of course, Hannibal is such an incredible show. So I had that going for it. But oh my gosh, I was at that time, I was, in the first blushes of passionate love for Hannibal. Sorry, my mic fell over. And I was telling everybody about it. I was talking about it all the time. I was you have to watch Hannibal. My friends were so sick of hearing about Hannibal, but I literally could not talk about anything else at that time in my life. And then 2 weeks later, I swear to God, I was I just decided it was summer, and I was working my first job out of college. I was like in a production company of all things. So that was great. I was just like so in love with Hannibal. It was a great summer, by the way. And I was just scrolling through Tumblr or something, and I saw that Mads Mikkelsen was giving a panel at the Apple Store. And at that time, the Apple Store in Soho and Manhattan just gave these panels where they just invited people. They were free. You could just come. And I was like, did I miss it? But no, it was like 2 days later. And I kid you not, like literally 2 days before this, I was like, oh, Hannibal's my favorite character. I love him. And then like Maz is coming into town. So I was like, I told my office, like, have to leave.
What was he doing at the Apple Store?
He was giving a panel on The Hunt. So they, at the Apple Store, held panels about movies and TV shows that were coming out. They don't do it anymore, really, but it was just like this event series that they had where there's like a little auditorium at the top of the Apple Store in Soho, and they just invited people, and they would just sit there, and there was like maybe like 30 to 40 people in the audience. So I was like, oh my God, it's tomorrow. So I was like, okay, I'm going. And then I went, and like I saw Maz, and I just literally fall in love with Hannibal. And they're like, Maz was, who's there? I think I asked a question. I can't swear to it, but I think in response, he said that Hannibal was a fallen angel for the first time, which he went on to say numerously. But I think I asked something about like how he perceived Hannibal. I'm not sure, I have to go back, but and then afterwards, he like stuck around and signed autographs, and like he's so beautiful, and somebody had dressed him in like actual clothes that day, and I didn't know he was just like a bit of like a like sweatsuit wearing Adidas bro, you know, he seemed so godly in that moment. So like I saw him, and like that really like cemented like this, like it's just such a good first experience in fandom. But I think fandom at the time was a much different fandom than fandom is sort of today, because it was like a normal fandom. We were all excited for more Hannibal. We were all watching the show. We were all talking about it, analyzing it, like all that great stuff.
Where did it congregate? Tumblr, Twitter? Where was
Tumblr?
The,
yeah, Tumblr, yeah. Yeah. That was definitely the time of Tumblr. For most fandoms. But yeah, Tumblr is definitely like where we spent most of our days. And I had many great experiences in that sort of first blush. But it wasn't really like, I had, again, similar to Supernatural, I had a few friends and we sort of saw each other sometimes, you know, if Maz was like doing a small con, or there was the Paley Center moment, which was amazing just before season 3. But we didn't really form these like sort of this intense community that exists now. And I think that really started after cancellation, because it was just kind of this huge blow to the whole fandom that we all sort of suffered together in a sense, but in another sense that sort of shared tragedy brought us together, because now we had this cause. That cause was to save Hannibal. And we all felt that to save Hannibal, we had to come together. And we did. And then, in a sense, the sort of community of being close to one another, working together, being the source of the content and the fandom, because there was no longer a sort of external source. Although, of course, Brian provides, you know, has been there every step of the way, and we really couldn't have done it without the love of the cast and crew sort of continuing to support efforts, inject new material, interacting with us. That all came together. But I think that sort of having the show became replaced with having each other. And that's where we are now, and it's amazing.
Were you, by the way, at that New York TV festival screening of Wrath of the Lamb where Brian Skyped in?
And yeah, I was.
Yes, we were there too. And that was for both of us, but maybe even me especially, because Beth had been in a couple of fandoms. Mm-hmm. That was really my first brush with like
fandom. Oh, wow.
And seeing it manifested, because it wasn't typically... my fan behavior didn't really manifest as joining fandoms. I remember I own a suit that is not It's not Hannibal's red suit, but it's a pretty great reddish plaid suit. And I was saying to Beth, should I wear that to this thing? I don't know. Maybe. And then I was like, you know what? I'm not going to be that guy. And I went, and then everybody was flower crowns.
Yes. Yes. You saw the fully manifested vision of late stage Hannibal fandom, or present stage, we can even say, which I think is just such a wonderful thing. I think a lot of people who join or have joined more recently maybe look back and they're like, oh, well, I wish I could have been there when the show was airing. And like, yes, undoubtedly, when the show was airing, it was a wonderful experience because we had the show. But it was a much different experience because we didn't, in a sense, have each other. So should the show ever come back, then we would have both the show and each other. And, you know, that would be the ultimate like joy one could have. But I think it's so interesting that kind of because Hannibal became about supporting one another in this truly communal way, not to make it culty and weird, although of course it is, but in a sense, I feel like the function of the fandom doesn't function too dissimilarly to having, you know, like a religious community or any other kind of close bond community where if you need help, you reach out to someone and someone will help you. If you're visiting a new state, you're like, oh, like, do you want to meet up? And Fannibals will come meet you. You know, like, it's just like there's a lot of like, you know, like charity work and events and like coming together to celebrate and, you know, working together for common goals and things like that, that I think is like the same as any other really strong community. So I think that's beautiful in a sense, and maybe not something that necessarily exists in every fandom. And I think that moment of cancellation, as harrowing as it was, allowed us to adapt, evolve, become this new creature of fandom.
What's going on right now? Like, are there any events or specific things that are going on within the fandom right now or upcoming?
Yeah. So I help run a Twitter. I'm called the Fannibal Movement, and we do a bunch of things. We're rewatching Hannibal right now. I'm with the hashtag Honor Every Part.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of have this ongoing like Fannibals in Bloom tag where you can share flowers or your flower crown. I also run a Hannibal Events Twitter where I retweet kind of just a feed of things happening or, you know, things that people need. There's like a bunch of sort of Discord communities that are popping up. There's a pop culture issue. I'm some Kickstarters, this real Hannibal event, giveaways. There was a Trans Hanny Day to celebrate sharing new and old trans, non-binary, and gender fluid content. We had the Hanniversary just recently where we celebrated Hannibal's 9th birthday. Things are happening.
So we'll get from you an extensive list of these destinations and hashtags, and we'll post them in the show notes so you don't feel the pressure to tell them all to us at this moment. But there's a lot.
Yes.
One thing I think we wanted to talk about was, well, the way the show ends, the series finale, maybe. To date, it's the series finale.
Mm-hmm.
I feel is a pretty perfect series finale.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a whole episode about series finales, and we discussed what we think makes a good series finale. I think we talked about a lot of different things, like that you want the characters behaving in character. You want the situations to be consistent with what's gone before in terms of tone and content. You want really a series finale to kind of be a summation or a closing argument of what the whole series's ethos has been leading up to. And you want, for me, I want a feeling of this is the way it had to end. Like there's a feeling of inevitability that this is the place where this ends. You wrote an article, which I mentioned to you. I had no connection with you or knowing who the author was, but I had read this article that you wrote, Broken Narrative, Promises, Supernatural, Marvel, and More for the Mary Sue. And I had read that article and I sent it around to a bunch of people because it really spoke to me. It was really a beautifully conceived and expressed piece on what we can expect from creators and sort of this understanding of there's certain things we can't demand of creators just because we want something to go in a particular direction. But I think what you posit, and I feel was very much true, is that when a promise has been made by a creator through the behavior of the characters, the situation of the characters, the performance of the actors, that you have to fulfill that. And if you don't fulfill that, it's a real betrayal to your audience. But can you just talk a little bit more about that idea and what you discuss in that article?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's definitely an age of certain fans who are entitled and they throw fits if things don't go their way. And that I think is unproductive and toxic behavior. However, I think that when you as a creator ask us as fans to invest in a text, then we thus have the right to be like, we're investing in something that's real. You know, like we are reading this and this is what has happened. And we can expect that the show doesn't forget what has happened and instead builds on what has happened. Because otherwise it's just like haphazard. And how can we invest in something if the past can always change behind us and the future doesn't speak to what has come already? So I do think that there's also maybe this idea of wanting to have shocking things, or in this day and age, a very, you know, the possible interference of the powers that be of studios and networks. And those are just things that happen. But then you can get a narrative that doesn't seem to follow through from what we have watched as the text, the canon text of the show. And when that happens, it does leave you as a viewer, as somebody who's invested a lot of time, feeling, as you said, quite betrayed, because I've now invested my time and then it's just for nothing, really, because everything I thought I could read and understand from the show has not come to fruition. And that's not a ship thing. People are always like, oh, you're mad about the ship. It's a narrative thing. It's a story. You read a story and you expect coherency in the story you read. Of course, that coherency can come in many ways and maybe not necessarily the way you think it should. But if two characters have had a very meaningful bond, you don't expect that bond to simply disappear without a reason, because that narratively makes no sense. So that's what Hannibal does so well, is that it remains true to the story, and the story is the focus sort of above everything else. The show remains loyal to the story it tells, which is why The Wrath of the Lamb is so satisfying, because it's a culmination of a story that has been told. And it still, in a sense, feels shocking and delightful. And we didn't expect it, in a sense, you know, all of those great things still happen, but it's satisfying because the promise of the show is kept coherent in that episode. And it's such a triumph to fans who've been watching, because they feel thusly seen by the show. And in a sense, I think that because The Wrath of the Lamb is such a triumph and a culmination of everything we've invested in, that we could live this long as a fandom. I think had it been any less spectacularly wonderful, then it would be hard to keep a fight for a show going for 6 years after cancellation. But because it is so perfect, that we left on such a high note from that moment, that stays with us, and that's such a bolstering and beautiful feeling of being seen, that of course we want more Hannibal.
I think it's interesting that, you know, in a way, I think people sort of react by saying, oh, that's just because this was your ship and you wanted this ship to happen. I mean, that's an easy thing to say, I think, in part because in a lot of these movies or series, the creators have played into the ship, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, sometimes in a queer baiting way, or sometimes mm-hmm. just because that was actually what was just seemed to be naturally emerging
yeah.
from the content. And then they just back away because they're right. afraid of it, or they're just hostile to it.
I think it's a logical fallacy to say that this is about the ship. In fact, there's a third variable, and the third variable is we watched the show or the property. Because we watched the show or the property, we ship it. Like, that's, mm-hmm. we, you know, obviously people can ship anything, but when there's such a feeling of devotion, usually that has come from the canon itself. It doesn't just happen. Because the sort of the premise of we watched the show that was as it was written, that's what led us to the outcome of shipping. And it is now what leads us to the outcome of being upset at this ending, because we watched the show as it was written, and this ending does not equate with the show that we watched, I think is where many series finales lose it. And I think it's incorrect to then bring the shipping into it, because the shipping comes from the same place of we dedicated ourselves to watching this property, but it has nothing to do with the upset of the show didn't follow through on what it set out and its premises that we then watched. It's like there's the top and the two things branch out of it, and they might both be true, but they don't have anything to do with each other. So that's how I perceive it.
I think you make a really good point in that article with this about Endgame, because as you say, you could be the biggest ducky shipper in the universe, and you did not believe for a second that that was ever going to be reflected in any movie. It just
not
wasn't going to happen.
Not for a literal second.
And you can be a very happy Stucky shipper without hoping that that will occur in the movies. But,
yeah, absolutely.
But what the flaw, the fatal flaw that happens in Endgame is that they just act like they never built up the relationship right. between Bucky and Steve as the most important relationship either of them has ever had. And so that the loss of Bucky again and again and again just gets dropped as if it was just nobody to him.
But
exactly. Nobody
and
to
there's
Steve.
There's no resolution to that. I could go on about Endgame forever, but we'll just leave it at there's just no resolution to the story. There's no resolution to explain why Bucky might no longer be important to Steve. We didn't see that. If we saw that, then it would be a part of the narrative and maybe we could understand. We wouldn't like it. But there's just nothing. They just sort of decide, like, goodbye. We won't address this. We won't talk about it. This will never come up again after, like, this moment. And this important plot line, arguably the most important plot line for the important character of Steve Rogers, who one cannot deny is an important character in this Avengers universe, simply goes unfinished.
Not just unfinished. I mean, to me, this is what's really yes. annoying to me, is yes. that they
demolished.
They horned in Peggy as the aftermath of his grief of what happened.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And it made literal.
It made no sense. There was no sense to be had. So that's where you lose. That's where you lose an audience, an avid audience who has followed these characters, and suddenly you have gone off the rails in a way that the narrative doesn't support or lead you through in any way. It's just like, we wanted this to happen, so we switched it. And that's where we are now. And then that obviously engenders a feeling of loss and unhappiness. So, you know, it's a broken narrative promise, because the narrative before Infinity War and Endgame was very clear that they're quite important to one another. Like, devastatingly important to one another. So
I actually felt the insult even got extended in the Falcon and the Winter Soldier series, because it is for other characters, many, many other characters, to say no one will ever replace Steve Rogers. And that whole sentiment gets offloaded into a million other characters, mm-hmm. except for the Winter Soldier, right? It becomes about the Falcon's journey and transformation into Captain America. And that becomes the no one ever is ever going to replace Steve Rogers conversation.
Right. I mean, I think that show had to uphold Endgame in a sense. So there was, it just had that sort of base that it had to work with. And there was maybe nothing that could have been done off of that premise to save it, because that premise was so flawed. Sam, of course, has an important relationship with Steve, and that makes total sense. The total sense of the narrative of the Falcon and the Winter Soldier is that both Sam and Bucky have lost their best friend. And over that loss, they can come together and evolve. But that is simply a missing part of the show. So that's what happens in these big franchises sometimes, where I feel perhaps the story is not the most important thing. But happily in Hannibal, the story is the most important thing. So... That's the difference you can see and feel.
I was telling Matt, and I think I may have mentioned this the other day. I don't know if you watched BBC Sherlock at all, but mm-hmm. that was a very, very, very contentious community. It was contentious within the community. It was contentious between communities and the creators. And that was a show where there was such overt portrayal of this relationship, not only as a very intense, close relationship, but one that appeared to be romantic or burgeoning on romantic. It was overt.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And it really turned out actually to be queer baiting, because,
right.
And there's a thing that happened. I don't know. I had a reaction to Matt. You can cut this out if I'm going on too long about this, because it's such a pet peeve of mine that drives me crazy.
That's what we're here for.
At the end of season two, when, spoiler if you haven't watched BBC Sherlock, don't listen, but there's the Reich and the fall.
Sure.
He jumps off the roof in front of John.
Yes.
It breaks John. John sees it. He appears to be dead. John touches his head. But we know by the very end of even that episode that he isn't dead.
Sure.
And of course he's not dead, because it's the show, but John doesn't know he's dead. When they come back in season three, they did a thing where they had they portrayed a fan group of people who believed Sherlock was alive. That fan group was led by Anderson, who had been portrayed up to that point as someone who was not smart, not mm-hmm. worthy of respect, and an ineffectual antagonist to Sherlock. He was the leader of that fan group. And then they had, through these members of the fan group, portraying what fan communities had been talking about during the hiatus, where there had been rampant discussion and interesting discussion about how Sherlock actually survived the fall. And they put those theories into the mouths of these losers, including a slash theory. And I remember feeling like, when I watched that episode, feeling like they are really saying fuck you to the fans. They are saying, like, all your speculation and fan engagement is silly, and particularly this idea of slash relationships in this series is silly. And I personally felt very, you know, I wasn't an, I was My fandom was I watched the show, I talked about it with friends, I would occasionally post comments on Tumblr, whatever.
Sure.
But I just felt so disrespected because I really felt like the creators were, it wasn't an endearing look at the fans to me.
Right.
It felt like an insult to fans. And the pushback from the creators saying your ideas about this relationship being romantic in canon is ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
They went to such lengths to disabuse the fans of that notion that the characters just became completely foreign to who they'd been for two seasons. And I also think many people would have been satisfied without a canonical romantic relationship if they hadn't reacted so, if the creators hadn't reacted so aversely to that, that they ruined the relationship entirely.
Right, exactly.
And so that to me is just one, is a very big example. And the show went completely awry. I mean, the show deteriorated in quality so badly because they just didn't know what they were doing with these characters or situations anymore. And the contrast between that and what occurs in Hannibal is not be more, it couldn't be more stark. And because, and it's, you know, you could say, oh, people wanted a kiss or people didn't want a kiss, but like the absence of the kiss or the lack of a kiss was so unimportant.
Sure.
In Hannibal.
Yeah.
Because they gave you everything you could have hoped for, which was an acknowledgement that this was an intensely romantic, loving, unique relationship. And that's all we wanted because that's what this show led up to. And it really belies this idea that fans are demanding something that they're not entitled to when all they want is a fulfillment of what the show has established.
Exactly. If you set out to prioritize two characters in their relationship, then the expectation is that we follow through on these two characters and their relationship, that we don't just suddenly lose that relationship, that that relationship doesn't just vanish or change without any sort of obvious like narrative impact, like something changed between them. So the relationship has changed. It's just like suddenly they're apart or they won't talk to each other or they're not together. Or they have no screen time or something like that. Then that is where that kind of hurt comes from. And I think it's interesting in Sherlock because even if you set aside like the sort of John and Sherlock narrative, which undoubtedly is the heart of the show, then you could just look at the Reichenbach Falls as like an entity, and that the narrative promise there was that like this was an important fall, like this was done in some way. We would understand that way. We would understand the importance of this fall. This fall would have great impact, and it really didn't. Like the sort of repercussions of that huge dramatic emotional moment vanished almost in a, you know, in a heartbeat. So. Kind of similarly to what I talked about with Civil War and the Avengers. Like there was such a break, there was such hurt, and that hurt was never really resolved narratively. The narrative just kind of was left hanging and suddenly they were back together on the same team. You know, there was never this like emotional narrative engagement with that break or with the fall. And that just feels like a big gap to fans who are watching, who had been teed up to be like, these are huge, important moments. We should expect repercussions, consequences, fallout from these moments. And we just never got any of that in these instances.
Only in fic.
Whereas with Hannibal, in Mizumono, like those repercussions go on. Like we steep in them almost to the point where we could steep in them no longer, you know. Like, it doesn't just happen and suddenly we've forgotten about Mizumono and have just moved on to the next thing. No, that happened and the narrative knows that it happened and it continues to engage with it and with the consequences of it.
Now, just speaking of kissing, would you have wanted to see a kiss other than perhaps personally? Would you have wanted to see a kiss narratively, or do you think that would have detracted from Wrath of the Lamb?
Yeah, I think that having a kiss would have neither detracted nor enhanced Wrath of the Lamb. It certainly would have. It simply would have been a different, you know, that is simply would have been what had happened. And I mean, I don't know, because we didn't see it happen, so it's hard to compare whether or not it would have been how that would have been. I think that a kiss would never detract. So let's say I don't think that like a physical sort of engagement could somehow detract from the bond such as Will and Hannibal's. And I think there's like a slippery slope of being like this might detract from the perfection of the purity of their relationship or something like that. Because I don't think that kind of queer physicality is a detractor. But I don't think it was necessarily necessary in that moment. That moment exists in perfection. So I don't think I would say that I need a kiss in that moment, nor do I think a kiss would have somehow harmed the magic of that moment. I think that's where I fall on that.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I don't think there's I don't think that a kiss, I don't think the thing about a kiss would be we can't have a kiss because their relationship is so much, it transcends sex. That's not my feeling. I do feel, what I've come to feel, I think,
sure,
is while I would love to see the two of them kiss, happily. I think that it could have become reductive in that moment or distracting in that moment, which is not to say that if we were to move on to a season four,
right, exactly,
I wouldn't expect to see physicality in their relationship. What do you think? What, in terms of a season four, what would you want to see? What have you imagined seeing?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've sat with the idea of a season four for so long that it has almost become like a white noise in my mind. I really don't know anymore what I would imagine. Obviously they go to Cuba. I would like to see them together, because I felt like in season three they were apart for so long. So it would be nice to have them together in a space for a time, in this isolated space perhaps, where they're only real to each other and nobody else really knows who they are. I think it would be really cool to see more sort of memory palace sequences and bring back people like Bev and Abigail and other folks like that to kind of give them the ability to continue to live in the story despite their deaths. But really I would leave it to Brian in that sense. And I feel just like complete confidence that whatever season four would be at the moment where season four becomes a reality, that it will be perfect. Just as everything that has come in Hannibal has been perfect.
I have gone back and forth personally about whether I would really want it or not, because Wrath of the Lamb does feel like such a perfect conclusion.
Sure.
And seasons 1, 2, and 3 feel like such a perfect package. I do obviously agree that Brian Fuller is not going to do this unless he could do it the way he's supposed to do it. And I know from what I understand, maybe you know a little bit more about this, it seems like it's a couple of times maybe even come to the verge of starting up again, and it's had to pull back. Is that accurate, or is that not quite true?
I think it's really hard to say. I think in the world of production, things are always almost happening, so just constantly, you know, and conversations are picking up and falling through. I don't have any personal knowledge of how many times it has come close to happening or not. I think maybe Maz mentioned it, you know, there was times where they thought it was happening. But I like to say that I think that Hannibal is always as far from and as close to being picked up for a season four as it ever is. I don't think there's ever a time where it's impossible, nor is there ever a time where it's happening until it happens, and then we'll know it happened. But I don't think we ever move farther away or closer to, you know, like, that's like, I think it's like such a fallacy to be like, oh, it's been so long, Hannibal can never come back, because things are coming back all the time now. 10 years, a game just came back that first was played in 1992. Like, that's 30 years, you know, not that we want to wait 30 years for Hannibal, but it's never a lost cause, is my personal perspective. So I think that if anybody ever thinks to themselves, like, it's been so long, it'll never come back, I don't think that's true at all.
Yeah, and I've been reconsidering this recently. Not as recently as I've been reconsidering Chia, which only happened starting 2 hours ago. But I read a great book. It's called Blood, Sweat, and Chrome by Kyle Buchanan, and it's an oral history of the making of Mad Max Fury Road, which is, you know, arguably one of the best action movies ever made. I love it. And one of the things you take away from that book is it took a full 20 years to get that movie made.
Absolutely.
Including a few times when it seemed like it was about to be made, only to get pushed by acts of God. It really almost got shot in 2005. The cool thing about it is George Miller and his team never stopped working on it. Year after year, they were just adding more texture and backstory and thematic undercurrents and building physical props and storyboarding it. And did you read this book?
No, I didn't, but I've seen it in the zeitgeist.
And that's partly why the movie feels so rich and lived in and is such a remarkable feat of world building, because it was going on for 20 years. And when Beth and I had talked about DiGiustivo previously, we talked about the fact that that shirt that Hannibal dresses, I think Will in, has hidden production design elements. Like, there's a monogram in the shirt that shows that Hannibal made it for him, right? No one's ever going to see that. And Beth and I talked a bit about movies like The Lobster and The Shining, where there are hidden production elements that no one would ever see on camera, but were there for the world building and texture. And this is really true with Fury Road. Like, like, it just never stopped. They never stopped working on it. And finally, when they shot it, a lot of the anecdotes say that these cars and these spaces and the costumes and all this stuff, there's so much detail on them that never gets put on camera. But that is one of the reasons why the world feels so textured and real. And the last 7 years or whatever have certainly been full of false starts and fan speculation.
Yes.
It's hard to imagine that Brian Fuller and the team haven't kept thinking about it, right?
Yeah, and I think you bring a really interesting point, because I think in a sense, like I was talking about with fandom and cancellation, I think in a sense, fandom brought everybody closer. I think it brought the Fannibals together. I think it brought Brian and the Fannibals closer together. I think there's just this great kind of community that has been built in that time that likely would not have been built in this way had we simply gotten renewed for a season four. So I think that that is, in a sense, a positive. You know, I don't know what the world would have looked like if they just renewed Hannibal that day, but I know that In a sense, many great things have come out of them not renewing Hannibal that day. And I think should they renew Hannibal now, we would, as I said, have Hannibal and this community, and we would be so close together to experience it. That would be like a truly wonderful thing. That is an experience we could not have had the show simply continued. And I think that steeping in it, sitting with it, The Wrath of Lamb was so monumental. So I think that all of that could allow just, you know, for, as you say, more texture, more richness, more thought about all of it, which will pay off in even better season four. I know the sort of underlying question here is like, should we have a season four? And I think I don't know. I think that that's like an obvious answer, because if Brian and Co. delivered such a magnificent seasons 1 through 3, why should we imagine now that season 4 would be anything less than more magnificent than the seasons 1 through 3 have been? There's I think we've all been burned by media is the real truth. All those broken narrative promises, they haunt us because other shows, other properties have dropped the ball. They have fumbled, but Hannibal has never fumbled, and we have no reason to imagine in a season 4 it would do anything but deliver the next brilliant season, in my perspective. So I'm like, yes, bring the season 4, because it will not damage the show in any way. I see no reason to believe that is true.
I think it can't damage it. Really, a lot of based on this reading I was just doing about Fury Road, there's a lot of, you know, by necessity, the Will and Hannibal relationship is going to have to be lived in by the time we rejoin them, right?
Yes.
I think you can't just de-age the actors and act the day after Wrath of the Lamb. And I really like that. I like the idea. I mean, I'm not going to do like verbal fic, but like, I like the idea that they might be at the point where Hannibal's like, don't put that sausage in the microwave. You're going to ruin it, right? Like that there's actually like they've been at this a really long time.
They've had life together. I think that'd be great too. I think you'd be so beautiful. I think that there's a plan. I don't know this. I think that there's a plan for Hannibal at any point that Hannibal could come back. If it's next year, if it's 5 years from now, if it's 30 years from cancellation. You know what I mean? Like, I think there would be a way to have more and for that more to work and be amazing. And, you know, like, of course, there was a time where, like, it seemed the end of the world that there was not right now a season 4. And I think that has softened for me into something more wistful. I feel such a great affection for the show. I feel like there's not a character I don't love. There's not an episode I don't love. I love everything about it. And should there be more, I will love that too. And that's, I think, kind of where I am.
And why do you think Hannibal, I mean, I know what my feelings are about this show, but why do you think Hannibal is the show that spoke so deeply to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's such an interesting question, because I feel like falling into fandom is akin to falling in love. I think a part of it is just this sort of purely like analytical notion of like the quality of the show. Like, it's well written, it's stunning, it's, you know, it follows through on all its tenets, it's satisfying, it's smart, it's gorgeous. And so just on a pure quality place, it's just like nothing else. And then of course, just it is such a show about being seen and finding people who can see you, and that's kind of the beautiful project of the show. It's such a queer show, and there's so many queer sensibilities in it, in this bucking of norms, rejection of society, the remaining true to yourself, building a space where you inhabit with other people who understand you. I think those are all really powerful qualities and sort of aims of the show that spoke so loudly to me and to, I think, many people in the fandom. I can only speak to my own experience, although anecdotally, you know, I think this is an experience that people share, is that like when people start watching Hannibal, they, over the course of the show, they just understand themselves in a new way. I think Hannibal helped me kind of on my journey in queerness. Like, I understood myself to be more queer after watching Hannibal, or that I am queer. Like, it helped brought me a queer community, because so many people who seem to enjoy the show all kind of were also on these sort of queer journeys. It's like this amazing sort of really queer forward, fabulous space where everybody kind of has fallen in love with Hannibal. And especially here, I made a lot of kind of real life friends, a community around me that is like my friend community now. Like, it's just, those are the people who I love, who live in this world around me, who I meet with, who I have lunch with, who I see regularly. So I think it just really brought this community and this feeling of being seen and this beautiful sort of devotion to telling a story in such a satisfying and beautiful way that you must fall in love with it.
Yep, yep. Well, I just learned, by the way, yesterday I was pulling some statistics on our podcast, and nice. We had just crossed the 100-hour mark of discussions that we published about Hannibal. This was just such a good conversation to, I think, kick off the next 100 hours.
Yes. And
it's really, really, really great to talk to you about this stuff. It's absolutely. It's just
my
been
pleasure.
Wonderful.
It's so much fun, for sure.
Tell us where we can find you just before we go.
Oh, sure. Well, I'm on Twitter at moondancer1626, which is indeed a relic of my AIM screen name. But that's where I am. That's where my face has grown, so to speak. So that's what we're sticking with. I'm on Instagram. I post less there at rotem_rusak. In my Twitter bio, there's kind of a link to some of my written work for various publications. And of course, I have an author page at Nerdist with the rest of my work. And I will send these links, but I help run a Twitter that's just at Hannibal Events, where I try to just have a feed of like things that are happening with no other commentary. So it's just purely, you can scroll down that for an idea of things that are happening in fandom. And I help run a Twitter called the Fannibal Movement. There's an E missing. I'm in the at just because it was too long. So it's Fannibal Move MNT. I will also send that. But if you probably type Fannibal Movement into Twitter, you can find it. And that's actually been an account that's been up since 2016. We kind of started it right around cancellation to just, you know, organize events to like trend Hannibal at the time. These days, we still do that sometimes. We also just organize like celebrations and rewatches and things of that nature. So a lot of fun.
Terrific.
Yay.
Yay.